So we'll move into our next speaker here. Dr. Deborah Swackhammer will be speaking with us about looking far into the future, the Minnesota Water Sustainability Framework. Dr. Swackhammer is professor and Charles M. Denny Jr. Chair in Science, Technology, and Public Policy in the Hubert H. Humphrey School of Public Affairs and co-director of the university's Water Resources Center. She's also a professor in environmental health sciences and in the School of Public Health. Dr. Swackhammer currently serves as chair of the Science Advisory Board of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and on the Science Advisory Board of the International Joint Commission of the U.S. and Canada. She was appointed to serve on the Minnesota Clean Water Council and was instrumental in developing the sustainability framework. So from here, I'll turn it over to Dr. Swackhammer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the invitation to come and share the framework with you today. I know many of you were part of this, and many of you have heard this talk before, but I just think, you know, you can't hear it enough, right? It's just thanks for inviting me. The previous two speakers have done a fabulous job of setting up the framework for me. Both Representative Torkelson and Princesa have done a wonderful job of setting the stage, and I think you'll see that there's lots of overlap and synergies and tensions in some of the things that were already said this morning. So the framework, what is the framework? So back when in 2008, after we voted in the constitutional change to create the Clean Water Land and Legacy Act, if you will. The first thing that the legislature did as a result of suddenly having this very large pot of money called the Clean Water Fund was to say, well, what we really don't want to do, and you heard Representative Torkelson say this, we don't want to look back in 25 years and say, oh my goodness, did we just squander a whole bunch of money by putting it out in very unconnected, our favorite little pet projects, and at the end of the day find out that we really hadn't done much to improve our water resources around the state? So the legislature commissioned the Water Resources Center at the university to conduct a study to develop a framework which would be a long-term plan for how to reach water sustainability for the state of Minnesota. The idea here wasn't to be a specific spending plan. That's what the Clean Water Council and that's what the legislature does, is develop the spending plans. But this idea was to inform the legislature for what a group of experts would think are the highest priorities for the state and what are the things that are necessary to do to achieve sustainability of our water resources. There are three key words here. One is sustainability, and I'll come back to that. The other is that it's comprehensive. Many states have water plans. They're usually focused on one aspect of water management, groundwater, surface water, something. But in our case, what we wanted to do was to develop a plan for the state that addressed both groundwater and surface water, something near and dear to your hearts, that addressed human health as well as ecological use of water, and addressed water quantity as well as water quality. And so we addressed all of those intersections in a very comprehensive way in this framework. And the other idea was to make sure that the plan was integrated, meaning that it took into account. The other thing is that we wanted it to be integrated across all the different, the many people that touch water in the state of Minnesota, from all those, the federal agencies, the state agencies, all the different local units of government. We wanted to make sure that we were integrating our approach to water management, including all of those stakeholders. The legislature defined for us the concept of sustainability. So we didn't waste the first 6 months of our 18 months project defining sustainability. We started with this in the actual language of the law. So sustainable water use is when we do not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. It's a lofty kind of erudite definition, but it really just states some things that are very important. Notice that ecosystems is in the definition of sustainability. It's not all about us as humans. And that we're talking about all future generations, not just next generation, not just our grandkids. We're talking about all future generations. Now, the legislature also spelled out in the statute what areas we needed to address. We needed to address drinking water, storm water, agricultural use of water, industrial use of water, surface and groundwater interactions, infrastructure needs for water, And then finally, the intersection of all of those water uses and needs with the stressors of climate change, land use, development, and demographic change. So a pretty tall order. We were asked to address just about everything you can think of when it comes to water in the state. We were also required to do a collaborative approach, but frankly, that's why they came to the university. That's what we do. We pull together people and convene different perspectives and different groups of people, and we have the ability to do that as sort of a, you know, the honest broker, if you will. So we worked with all of the state agencies that touch water, and you can see there's quite a few of them, DNR, MDA, MDH, the PCA, EQB, and Bowser were all very much involved in this process. And then we also included other parts of the water infrastructure and when it comes to people. We included the watershed districts, the WMOs, the soil, water, and conservation districts, a whole bunch of different water-related NGOs, and then the counties and the cities. We also included lots of individual citizens, and ultimately we had more than 250 people involved in this project. And when I say involved, I don't mean they came to a meeting. I mean they came to many meetings. They reviewed the document. They participated at a very high level. The approach we took, and I want to explain the process because I really want to underscore how collaborative this process was. Again, Representative Torkelson said you can't, he's a big believer in that you can't move forward and solve some of our tough problems by being unilateral. And we were anything but unilateral. We included just about every perspective you could possibly imagine, and we included as much science as we possibly could so that the framework is really based in the best science of the day. We had three groups to begin with, the Water Resources Center as project manager, if you will. The Headwaters Council served as our external advisory group. They met about every 6 months. They reviewed what we did and gave comment. They were the ones that were to make sure we stayed on track and we stayed big and bold. So they were our external advisors. We also had a citizen and stakeholder advisory group, and this was specific to being stakeholders. So the Headwaters Council was not a stakeholder group. They came from many walks of life. They had collectively about 300 years of experience in terms of being water experts, but they were not there to represent their agency or their perspective or their organization. They were there with their experience. The citizen and stakeholders group was specific to be a stakeholder group. They were there to represent their constituencies. They were there to make sure their constituencies knew about what we were doing. So that group functioned as essentially a communications conduit to connect us with citizens and stakeholders, bring their views to us, and to get our information back out. We had five technical work teams that had about 10 to 20, up to 30 experts, and these were technical experts around different water use. So we had a team on domestic use, a team on the coffee's ready? A team on energy and industrial use. We had a team devoted to recreational, spiritual, and cultural use of water. We had a team devoted to agricultural use of water. And we had a team devoted to ecosystem use of water. And so these were the technical experts, both university as well as government and non-university folks, private and public sector, that were all experts in these areas. In addition, we had three other teams, a team that looked at all of the water policy, both historically and currently, and gave an evaluation of where the gaps in policy are. So we had a policy team. We had an education team that looked at education delivery, both formal and informal, and where the gaps in education are in terms of water education. And we had a team looking at water valuation, meaning looking at the value of water economically. So that team was a whole bunch of economists. And then finally, we had the synthesis team. This team met weekly for 15 weeks and put together, ultimately, the framework. They worked long and hard to make sure that the best ideas rose to the top and that the most important issues were addressed. And here's where I get to say that, in fact, and all the information fed to the synthesis team, here's where I get to say what this framework is not. It's not a consensus document. The synthesis team was an advisory group to help really construct this, but ultimately, I would say there was a great deal of consensus around the issues we addressed, the strategies we identified, but it came down to specific things, specific recommendations. I very deliberately did not want consensus, because then we would have the lowest common denominator document, and that's not what I wanted. I wanted to hand the legislature the boldest document we possibly could. So we had people in the on the synthesis team that didn't agree with every recommendation, and I think that's healthy. So I wanted to make sure that you understood that. Now, all of these teams produce papers. So we have 11 different background papers that are summary documents that summarize water use, water quality, water availability. They summarize all the different uses and what we know and don't know about those uses. And then each of those teams ultimately framed up what are the issues that must be addressed to reach water sustainability. And all of those papers are on our website at wrc.umn.edu. Now, ultimately, all those teams, as I said, they addressed and presented the synthesis team with what are the issues that must be addressed now that they provided us the state of the art and the state of the science, if you will, of water use in Minnesota. And we found 90 such issues. But they grouped nicely under 10 what we called the big issues, 10 major issues that the state faces. And what's kind of curious, and you'll see this, every one of those issues is a national issue. These aren't isolated to Minnesota. We're not living under a rock somewhere. We actually represent and are very representative of the issues being faced by the nation as a whole. These 10 issues collect under three categories of sustainability. Six of the issues are environmental in nature, two of them are economic in nature, and two of them are social in nature. So what are these issues? And I'm going to go through each of these issues again so you don't have to memorize this list just yet. But the first six issues deal with the environment itself. So the first issue is the need for a sustainable water supply. The next big issue is our struggle with excess nutrients and other conventional pollutants. The third issue is contaminants of emerging concern, already mentioned by Princesa. The fourth is land-water connection, and Paul also mentioned that. Ecological and hydrologic integrity, we'll talk a little bit about that. And the water-energy nexus. These are the six big issues the state faces from an environmental perspective when it comes to water sustainability. In addition, there are two economic concerns, water pricing and infrastructure needs. Now, infrastructure is a physical need and a quality need and a quantity need, but I'll tell you the biggest issue that is really an economic issue, okay? The cost of that is enormous. And then we have two social issues, dealing with citizen engagement and education, and then finally with governance and our institutional arrangements around water management. For each of these issues, they're really very strongly related and driven by and affected by external drivers. And these external drivers include climate change. They include the change in demographics, where people live and how old they are and how they use the resource and how many of us there are, how we use the land, and then our energy needs. Energy is a huge driver of water, which I'll talk about more in just a minute, but it really stands out as a major external driver affecting water resources. And they're all interrelated. So if we have more people, we need more energy. If we have climate change, we need more energy. If we change the way we use land, it's probably because of people. So all of these major drivers are very interconnected with one another, and then they're interconnected with the major environmental issues and with themselves. And so the point being is that that list of 10 big issues isn't a list. It's a big system. And so you cannot deal with just one of these issues and then think you're really dealing with water sustainability. You need to be dealing with the water system as a whole in order to really manage it well. And then finally, these issues are completely affected by economic stresses and social stresses. So this one slide is meant to capture how interrelated all these issues are and the fact that it's a systems question. It's not a linear list of issues to be checked off as one deals with them. For each of these issues, because this was a report to the legislature, we describe in the framework what is the problem. It's not obvious to everyone that, say, the energy water nexus is a problem. So for each of these major issues, we describe the problem. We provide what we think is the desired future condition. In 25 years, what do we want the state to look like? We provide strategies for what to do to address the issue. We provide a series of recommendations for how to implement those strategies. And this really is where this plan diverges from almost every water plan you may have ever seen. It diverges from other state plans. It diverges from and takes the EQB plan, for instance, to another level. So it's a dense plan. It's 159 pages. And the reason it is because we get into great detail of how to do a strategy. So I'll give you some examples. We also provide benchmarks for how do you measure progress, making sure that you're doing the right thing and measuring and adapting, as Princessa pointed out. We provide benchmarks for how one would be able to do that. And then finally, we provide an implementation schedule. You can't address all of these 10 issues now. You can't take our 26 strategies and our 60 recommendations and put them into play all at once. So we recognize this, and so we've provided a timeline for implementation for each of these recommendations. And then finally, we provide as much information as we can to the legislature and others, and that's an impact matrix, where we not only talk about the cost of the a given recommendation, but we provide an estimate of the impact. So you do have some sense of which things are going to give you more bang for your buck, if you will. So now let me walk you through those 10 major issues and point out a couple of key strategies and recommendations, the ones that really rise to the top, that are kind of the most important ones, and perhaps the ones that impact and interest you the most. The first, for sure, interests probably everyone in this room. And it is our number one issue and our number one set of recommendations in terms of priority and to address quickly. And that is to make sure that the state has a sustainable and clean water supply. So notice we're addressing both quantity and quality. Recognize that if you have lots of water but it's dirty, it doesn't do you much good. So we're really talking about making sure we have enough clean water for the state into the future. Forever, essentially. So how do we manage it in a sustainable way? So the first strategy is we can't really manage our water resources without understanding them better. We do not have a water balance for the water in the state of Minnesota. We have some rough budgets, we have some estimates, but we do not know our water balance. We don't understand our bank account for water. We don't know what we deposit. We don't know how that water moves among our different accounts. We only know how much we use. So if you ran your bank account that way, you'd probably get in trouble financially really quick. And we don't manage our water resource account well. And so what we need to do is figure out what are the recharge rates. And mostly, what are the movements of water among our different aquifers so that we have a time-dependent understanding of not just a budget and a snapshot of time, but a true dynamic water balance for the state. So we have a number of recommendations. How do you do that? Well, we have some very detailed recommendations around how to do that in terms of accelerating the geologic atlas efforts and the aquifer mapping efforts that are ongoing, but we really recommend that those be accelerated. We also recommend the design and implementation of a complex model to get at this water balance. We also are suggesting that our water permit system be changed. This is a short-term approach. We recognize that getting our water balance is a very long-term effort. I mean, it's a 10 to 15-year effort in the best of estimates. And in the meantime, we're still not using our water well. So one of the things that we'd like to see happen is that our water permitting system be updated and be made more automated and be made more equitable. And so we have a number of recommendations around the permitting process. Suffice it to say that if you're familiar with the Michigan permitting process, and I know you have a speaker from Michigan speaking, we like the Michigan process. We would adapt it to Minnesota. And the big change would be is to make sure that minimum surface flows, that threshold for minimum surface flow, that you couldn't withdraw water for a permit if you surpass that minimum flow, and that would be based on ecosystem needs as opposed to minimum flow levels. And that right now is how Minnesota's law is written. So we would change, in an ideal world, we would see those minimum flows be based on ecosystem needs as opposed to some sort of minimal physical flow. The second strategy has to do with somehow getting at the issue of private well water that's contaminated or not. As you know, the state cannot control what happens with private wells. They don't have authority to do much with private wells. But one thing that we do recommend is that all of these private wells be mapped. We actually don't know where all the private wells are in the state, but the first thing would be to map them. And the second would be to require that these be tested for minimal pollutant levels, minimal numbers of pollutants, at the time of sale of the property and the time of refinancing of the property, so that there is a database that does get accumulated of how much nitrate or pesticide or arsenic you might have in that private well system. Now, this is an example of the implementation time frame, and this is to really just point out to you that many of these recommendations are long-term. Very few of our recommendations could be started now and finished in 6 months, which is, you know, the legislature thinks in terms of the six-month session or a two-year biennium budget. And this plan is not about that. This plan is about 25 years of investment and work to get to sustainable water management. And this gives you an idea of that. So even to complete the geologic atlases under our accelerated time frame would take over 10 years. Right now, the current plan would be to finish them in 24 years. So we're saying double that time. Do it twice as fast. And I know that requires people and training and resources, but we're saying do it. Get those resources, hire the people, do the training, and get those atlases finished. So you can see that we're really looking long-term. This is not a spending plan on a biennium budget basis, but a truly long-term plan for moving the state as far as we can possibly push it. The second big issue is excess nutrients and conventional pollutants. But what we mean by this is the pollutants that are covered under the Clean Water Act and by state standards, and so this has to do with TMDLs. The conventional pollutants are those pollutants that usually are in violation when one does a TMDL study. The first recommendation is to develop statewide nutrient management plans on the watershed scale. So this would include groundwater, surface water. This would be integrating sources of nutrients and pollutants from all sources. Instead of dealing with, you know, managing phosphorus and surface water from leaf litter and then treating wastewater treatment plants completely differently, instead of doing it piecemeal, consider nutrients as coming from a whole bunch of sources and deal with them as one big pollution problem. A phosphorus molecule doesn't know that it came from a wastewater treatment plant or from a tree. And so one needs to understand that you can't manage them as if they knew that. One needs to really be much more comprehensive and integrated in the management. The most controversial recommendation, perhaps, in the entire framework was already referenced in one of the questions earlier today. And it's a two-part recommendation. The first is that we would require that the implementation plans for a TMDL be required to be implemented. We would not only require an implementation plan to be developed, we would require that that plan be implemented and it be required by law. This is really because we feel that the voluntary approach to implementation simply has not worked, and that the trends for things like nitrates actually are getting much worse with time as opposed to better. So that the voluntary approach to fixing water pollution is not working. And so we are recommending that implementation plans be required to be implemented. The second aspect of this, if you're going to require them to be implemented, it does require that agriculture, as the currently unregulated part of the equation, be brought to the table as part of the solution. We have a very complicated set of recommendations about how to do this. And we basically, the elements of that are to have agriculture help. Agriculture would be treated as an area source, not as individual point sources. So a farm would not be a point source. A collection of agricultural land within a watershed would be considered an agricultural area that would have to meet minimum water standards just like other sources. If they were in violation of those standards, they collectively would have to figure out how to meet those standards. But they would get to decide how to do it. We would not dictate what BMPs would be used, or if they had to change cropping systems, or whatever they need to do. We're just saying they need to meet those minimum water quality standards. And if they were in compliance, nothing would happen. They don't have to file paperwork. They don't have to do anything. It's like if you're driving below the speed limit, you're just fine. And that's the idea here, is to treat them so that they, if they're in compliance, it's fine. And if they're out of compliance, there are consequences. But we do need to make sure that we're dealing with water quality issues and the solution to those issues in an equitable way. The third issue is contaminants of emerging concern, already mentioned. The The contaminants of emerging concern, really two major strategies here. One is to get upstream of the problem instead of having all these hundreds of contaminants of emerging concern in our environment and then trying to deal with them after they're here. Let's move upstream and get them out of our manufacturing waste streams. That's a long-term solution. That's a 20-year solution to getting green chemistry and green manufacturing into our society. But we feel that it's critical so that we stop the ongoing pollution of our environment with chemicals that aren't regulated. By the way, the difference between this and the previous issue, contaminants of emerging concern are for the most part unregulated. So these are contaminants in our water, in our drinking water, in our surface water, in our groundwater, that are in fact already shown to have ecological impacts. We don't know the human health impacts, but they're not regulated at all. And so we have this whole host of contaminants that haven't been dealt with. The next issue is the land-water connection. Our big recommendation here is to integrate water and land planning. And I'm thrilled to see that the Little Rock Lake case study is going to be talked about and that they do have integrated land and water planning, and that's great. Most of the state doesn't do a good job at this. There are some great examples where it's done well, but for the most part, the state doesn't do it well. And so we would require that land and water planning would be integrated and coordinated at the same scale and the same time frames. I'm also pleased to know that Representative Torkelson referred to the fact that he had actually introduced some legislation that was addressing this to some extent. I'm not familiar with his legislation on this aspect, but I'm thrilled to know that he is supportive of this particular recommendation. The next issue is ecologic and hydrologic integrity, and these two things are obviously very interrelated. You can't have a healthy ecosystem without a healthy water system, and so you not only have to have good hydrologic integrity to maintain your ecosystems, you also need healthy ecosystems to really keep everything else going. So our economy depends on both of those. So this is really a highly interrelated sustainability kind of poster child issue. Our first strategy is to protect critical areas, critical aquatic ecosystems. The second strategy is to deal with aquatic invasive species, and I'm pleased to see that, the current bill that's passing through the legislature and actually some of the ongoing implementation already underway at the DNR is completely in line with what our recommendations are. So we're already seeing some impact there. And the third strategy is to keep more water on the land and slow it down when you do leave the land. I was very happy to hear Representative Torkelson express the fact that he believes that this is an important thing to do and that he pointed to the strategies being used in the Red River Valley to do exactly that. That's one place we're doing it, but most of the problem is in the southern part of the state, and we really do need to do more to protect the hydrologic integrity and still protect our agricultural interests. And so we have a number of recommendations for how to deal with slowing down the movement of water off the land. We know we have to get it off the land to have productive farmland, but what we're looking to do is a number of different specific recommendations for how to do that, bring the water off more slowly, time the water, lower those peak flows, that kind of thing, to really protect both water quality and quantity, protect the soil, protect the productivity. We also, our fourth strategy has to do with making sure that we maintain marginal land in conservation easement. Economic pressures can force farmers to put land back into production that has lower productivity than their best land, but they might get more return for it than they do by keeping it out of production. And we're hoping that we can continue to work with both our state programs, but more importantly, work with our federal congressional delegation to make sure that the next version of the Farm Bill has very strong conservation elements in it. The next issue is the water-energy nexus. And this one is not so intuitive to people until they hear it, and then they go, oh, duh, that's obviously water and energy are quite connected. At the federal level, this is a huge issue, and it's gotten a lot of attention from both the Department of Energy and from the US EPA and the USGS, which are kind of the intersection of water and energy. And the issue is that it takes a lot of water to produce energy, and it takes a lot of energy to produce water. And if you just take Minnesota, 67% of our water use, although it's non-consumptive, but 67% of our water use is for cooling water for thermoelectric plants. That's energy. So we're using 67% of our water in an energy application. Paul mentioned biofuels. Biofuels is a big intersection of water use to produce energy, et cetera, and there are implications for water if we produce more corn or more other kinds of feedstocks for liquid fuel in the form of ethanol. And here you see an example of a wastewater treatment plant. It takes a ton of energy to clean that water. So you're seeing that we use a lot of energy to produce water, clean water, and a lot of water to produce energy. So our recommendation is to quantify those relationships. We know they exist. At the federal level, there's a big effort to begin to compile these relationships in a quantitative way. How many gallons of water produces how many, you know, kilowatt hours of energy. California has quantified all of those relationships for the state of California. We strongly recommend that Minnesota do the same. And the reason is you can't make good energy policy if you don't understand the implications of water, and you can't make good water policy if you don't understand the implications for energy. So both of those policies are so interrelated, you have to quantitatively understand those relationships. Now going to the economic issues around water pricing and valuation. Right now, we don't pay the true cost of water. We don't even know the true cost of water. But valuation of water is critical in order to manage water well. Right now, much of the cost of water, of either dirty water, is kind of, we don't pay for the dirty water. We pay for it indirectly with taxes that go to EPA that do TMDL studies. We really should be paying right up front for the damages we cause, the lost services that we cause in water, or the true costs of producing water to provide clean drinking water to our citizens. So our recommendations are to determine the true value of water and incorporate this into pricing schemes. Now, there have been estimates done, and we could probably, by a simple addition of $5 per water connection per year — you're already paying $6 for wellhead protection, by the way — you could do $5 a year per connection per year. That's it, $5 a year, one coffee. Oh, one latte, okay. And you could cover that additional cost of the lost ecological services for having provided drinking water, dug a well, et cetera, et cetera. It's not much. We can actually do this, and so we're recommending that, in fact, the legislature would do that, that they would add $5 to your drinking water bill to pay for the true cost of obtaining that drinking water. Another issue is having to deal with new technologies for cleaning water. I mentioned we have hundreds of these contaminants out there in water. They theoretically should be cleaned up by our wastewater treatment plants, but those technologies are new, they're expensive, and they're changing every day. I looked on the web yesterday, and I found 5 new articles on new technologies for advanced oxidation to treat wastewater for these kinds of contaminants. And we can't keep up with that kind of changing technology by passing a law. So we're recommending that there be a standing committee put together of engineers and wastewater professionals that can really advise the legislature on the long-term strategy that we should be following to build the right technology. The worst thing we could do is take the $100 million it might take to build a couple of treatment plants that might last another 40 years and build treatment plants that work for 1970s pollution. That would be the worst thing we could do. We want to build new plants that are going to really do the job. Speaking of building these plants and the expense, right now the way we do this, the way we build new water treatment plants and drinking water plants, is through the revolving fund, which is federal money that comes to the state, and then the state pays the matching that's required, and you get a new water treatment plant. The problem is the federal government is putting less and less into that revolving account. The state has less and less to match with, and yet we have many more plants that we need to build. Most of these wastewater treatment plants were built about 40 years ago at the passage of the Clean Water Act. They have a lifetime of 40 to 50 years. So guess what? All those early plants that were built as a result of the Clean Water Act are all now aging at the same time. They're going to need to get replaced in a relatively short period of time. And there's not nearly enough money from the federal government to pay for this. In fact, that gap shows you how quickly it's an exponential gap. And so we're going to have to pay for it ourselves, and we're going to have to figure out how to do that before it's a crisis. I don't think anyone wants to do without sewage treatment or without clean drinking water. So we're going to have to figure out how to do it before it's a crisis and how to do it equitably. And that's going to be quite the conversation. Finally, let me finish up with some of the social issues. We have recommendations around better public engagement, how to maximize public engagement and education. And we have recommendations and strategies around governance systems. One is to review all of our water policy, our energy policy, and our land policy for sustainability as a guiding principle and make those changes as necessary. The other is to make sure that we have appropriate cross-agency and cross-government governance. And we have suggestions about how to do that. And then finally, our final strategy is that we want to have this be a living framework. It should be reviewed every 5 years. It should be redone every 5 years. It should be adapted every 5 years. We can't predict 25 years from now. Think back 25 years and think if you could have predicted today. Not a chance. So we think that about 5 years is about what you can look to the future to. And so every 5 years, this document should be reviewed, the science updated, and the recommendations be updated. Now, we have 60 recommendations, 26 strategies, 10 big issues. That's a lot of information. We did prioritize it. We said, and actually these are coming from the university, as I said, this was not a consensus document. The University Water Resources Center feels these five issues, there are five things that have to be done. If you didn't do the others, that would be okay. Well, I wouldn't like it, but we could do without them. These five, if you don't do these, don't bother with the rest, in a sense. We're not going to get there. They are, under protecting water quantity and quality, to get this water balance done. That's you guys. This is the whole issue of understanding our complete water cycle for the state in a dynamic way. So understand our water balance. Revise our permitting process so that our withdrawals are efficient and equitable. Require the implementation of pollution reduction. So when you have a TMDL study and then you come up with the TMDL allocations and an implementation plan, require that those allocation reductions be accomplished with consequences if they're not, and provide equity, making sure everybody who's responsible for the pollution is responsible for the solution. So we feel very strongly if that isn't done, we're never going to have clean water in the state. And address these future contaminants. It's like a tidal wave coming at us. We are dealing with these five TMDL pollutants, and there's 105 that aren't regulated. So we need to deal with this large number of future contaminants. It's critical to integrate land and water planning. If we keep doing this in separate ways and separate scales, again, we'll never get there because that's planning is about the future. So we'll continue to make the same mistakes. And finally, we need to make sure that our policies make sense in terms of sustainability. If we're working against ourselves with our policies, we're never going to get there. So these are the five bullets that really, really matter. In the executive summary, and I've provided a number of copies of the executive summary and full copies on CD of the framework at the MGA, yep, at the booth. Go see the booth. Pick up two CDs, pick up an executive summary. In the executive summary, you will see this dashboard. And this dashboard has every recommendation on the left-hand side. Then it says who's going to implement it. Is it the legislature? Is it the executive branch? Is it a local unit of government? Whether it's a research task or something we can do now, we can get started because we know enough. The implementation phase, should it start now? Can it wait 5 years? Can it wait 10 years? So we put the timeline in play there. The level of benefit, not all of these recommendations are equal. I've already said five were really, really, really important relative to the others. And then finally, if there are multiple benefits, and again, I refer to Representative Torkelson, already talked about the incredible importance that if you do something but you get three or four benefits from doing it, that's a good investment. So we've recognized in the dashboard where you have multiple benefits for these recommendations. I will stop there. I hope you pick up a copy. I hope you read it. I hope you work at the state level, the local level, the watershed level to implement these recommendations, because I think if we do, we'll all have much better water for our future. Thank you.
Hi, Deb. How was this received by the legislature?
That's actually a fairly simple answer. The framework was requested by the last legislature in 2009, and this legislature, we turned it into this legislature in January of 2011, went to the Environment Committees in the House and Senate, and also to the Ag Committees. The good news is they requested hearings. We were the very first hearing of the session of any committee on the Hill, and they listened. They asked questions. I would say that the main recommendations we're talking about here had a chilly reception, particularly the ones around agriculture and TMDLs. They nodded. They didn't go to sleep or didn't put it on a shelf. I continue to have conversations, but I would say that it was received with a bit of a chill. That said, as you heard Representative Torkelson say, there are some things they are moving forward with that are not inconsistent with the framework. The land and water planning is an example. The adjustments to the Clean Water Council are a step in the right direction, in my opinion, that kind of thing. So tinkering around the edges. But the big ones, they're not really addressing. That being said, and Princesa referred to this, the executive branch is very much looking at the framework and looking for ways to maximize their ability to implement in the absence of legislative action. So I think we made sure that the implementation could be done not just by the legislature, but by both branches of government and the LGUs. And so there are aspects of this plan that can be implemented even with a legislature that's focused on other things.
Hi, you touched on the technologies for water treatment. Does the framework address any reuse of gray water and retreatment for potable supplies?
Yes, we do. Water reuse is in the issue of obtaining sufficient and clean drinking water supply. So that very first issue, water reuse, is addressed. We're urging the state to really plan for the future. Right now, we don't feel huge pressures to do water reuse. The state has issued a number of permits, a couple of hundred permits for water reuse, but it's not a huge priority in the state. It is being discussed, and we're trying to push so that we don't wait till we have a crisis and then go, oh, we should have water reuse. We want to make sure we have appropriate standards now, that we have design standards, that we have safety standards and health standards all in place, and then begin to make it so that it is cost beneficial to move in the direction of water reuse. So we address it, but we recognize it's not a pressing issue now, but we believe it will become a pressing issue in the next 10 years.
Great work and a good plan. One of the consequences, however, is it gives people things to be against. And this is what I've seen in the legislature this year is bills that are 10-1 opposed to the things that are in here. The ag community, the Chamber of Commerce, many people have come out. Bill number one was to reduce regulatory review. An early one was to put a moratorium on any water plans. So it seems like your work is being used more effectively by people opposed to this. So can you comment on that? And how do we educate those people to bring them to the knowledge that we have?
Jeff, that's a fabulous question, and if I had had a crystal ball and saw that the, 10 days after I finished the framework, I was going to be handing it over to such a hostile legislature when it comes to this kind of thing, I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have still handed it over, but I don't mind a good fight. I have been very discouraged that there has not been an opportunity to further educate. I really view the document we produced, because we outline the problems and the science, and we back it up with science, that the framework, I thought, could be used or should be used as an educational document as well. I don't expect every legislator or even every member of the Environment Committee to be familiar with every water problem. I have not seen that that's made a difference, that they have been mindful of the role that education can play in them reading the framework. On the other hand, I haven't given up on the legislature, but they do have they've made their priorities clear. So instead of beating my head against a wall at the legislature to promote the framework, I continue to just let people know about it, and really the implementation of it requires a commitment from the executive branch, which I'm pleased to say there's substantial commitment on that side, and commitment from all the various groups that are at different scales, the different LGUs in the cities and counties. There are many people that think the framework has merit, and I continue to be buoyed by the support that I get every time I give a talk on it, even when I'm talking to a pretty hostile audience, like the drainage guys. But they listen, and I can still have good conversations. And I think because we grounded this in science and we grounded it with 250 professionals from around the state, it's not just me. It's I'm able to have conversations with many other people, even if I haven't had meaningful, productive conversations with everyone at the Capitol, with anyone maybe at the Capitol.